We're talking about home in this hour. And coming home, that phrase, just think about it, coming home, it's supposed to be easy, right? Coming home is a relief, but it's not always. For instance, take veterans. Between 11 and 20% of veterans returning from Iraq or Afghanistan experience some form of PTSD. For them, coming home is both a relief and a struggle. War reporter Sebastian Younger knows what that's like, and he has an unusual new theory about why. In a new book called Tribe, he argues that it's not combat that's the problem. Instead, it's because there's something missing from our culture, the sense of being part of a tribe.
When I was young, I had an uncle figure named Ellis who was half Lakota Sioux and half Apache. And I remember when I was around 20, he said to me, you know, it was funny, all throughout the history of the United States, the white people were always running off to join the Indians, but the Indians never ran off to join the white people. And that always sort of stuck in my mind. I liked the idea of it. And then many years later, I'd spent a year off and on with a platoon in combat in eastern Afghanistan. It was a very rough place, 20-man position up on this ridge, a lot of combat. There was no internet. There was no even electricity for a while. It was really rough out there. And after it was all over, when the guys got back to Vicenza, Italy, where they're based, a lot of them said, you know, we don't want to go back to America. We'd rather, if we had the choice, we'd go back out to that outpost. And I remembered my Uncle Ellis, and I just thought, wow, what is it about modern society that's so unappealing on a human level? And so then it finally occurred to me, maybe the high rates of PTSD that we're seeing aren't a function of combat trauma. I mean, we're a species that's clearly wired to survive trauma, or we wouldn't be here. But maybe they're a function of trauma plus returning to an alienated individualistic society. Maybe that's what the human psyche really can't handle.
You spent years yourself, as you said, as a war reporter in some really difficult combat zones. You reported from Afghanistan, also from Bosnia. I mean, what has your own personal experience of this been, of coming home to America from a war zone?
Well, there's two components to it. I mean, if you go to a war zone, you're going to be traumatized. And I've come home with what I later realized was pretty severe PTSD. I mean, my experiences mostly happened before 9/11. So the term PTSD wasn't available to me to understand what I was experiencing. I just thought I was going crazy. And I had no, you know, I kept having panic attacks. And I had no reason to connect it to the combat that I'd been in. And so, you know, after some weeks or months, those panic attacks went away. But the other component of coming home is precisely what I was talking about before. If you travel in the developing world, war zone or not, you're in a close communal society. So Peace Corps volunteers, likewise, when they come back to America, about 25% of them sink into a real depression when they come home, which is just about exactly the estimated rate of PTSD in American soldiers, even though only around 10% of the U.S. military is engaged in combat. But 25% have significant psychological troubles when they come home. It's exactly like the Peace Corps, and it's exactly like my own struggles when I come home. It just feels like a sort of antiseptic, commodified society where people are just alienated from each other. I mean, this is the first time in history that people have been wealthy enough to have their own apartment, to sleep by themselves in their own room. I mean, that's unheard of in human society. Until recently. And as much as that is a liberty from the pressures of the group, there's also a significant and dangerous isolation there that really affects people.
You know, it's funny, you're describing us that way, and yet I would have said, I don't think I can go a day without seeing the word community someplace. I mean, you live in New England, this is fall, there are community harvest dinners in just about every rural area in New England. In my small city, there's constant talk about community justice forums or community charity drives. What is it that we're missing?
Well, you can't just stick the word on there and have it work some magic, right? Really, community in the anthropological sense, in the evolutionary sense, are the group of people clustered around you when you wake up in the morning. What you mean by community, if what you mean by that is the people are literally physically around you, that you depend on them for the food that you get, for the safety that you have, then you live in a real community. One of the things you see is even in modern society, when you introduce a crisis into modern society, like the Blitz in London or an earthquake or even 9/11 in New York, this communal feeling immediately happens. It's something that society does spontaneously in order to survive and defend itself. And as a result, you know, even a blizzard or a blackout, as a result, people look back with real fondness on times that should have been very frightening and hard. But people remember them very fondly precisely because, you know, the whole floor of your building is sort of clustered around one candle, you know, trying waiting out the blackout or whatever it is. And that feels good because it reproduces, again, our evolutionary past, what we're wired for.
You're reminding me that my mother-in-law is saying, she was in her 80s, after 9/11, the national mood reminded her most strongly of what it was like to be living here during World War II.
Yes, in America, after the Depression, during the Depression, World War II, I mean, these kind of crises bring about, even at the national level, a sense of unity. In New York City, I live in New York, the suicide rate went down in New York after 9/11. The murder rate, the violent crime rate went down. The great sociologist Emil Durkheim realized in the late 1800s that countries that were at war experienced a drop in their suicide rate, what are called antisocial behaviors, because people realize that their community needs them. I mean, one of the tragedies of modern society, along with all of its benefits, is that we're wealthy enough to have the idea that our community actually does not need our direct involvement. Our society does not need our direct involvement. We are effectively unnecessary for the survival of others. And that's really, really demoralizing. They've even found with older people that if they feel necessary to those around them, they will live longer. Hmm. And older people that feel unnecessary tend to die more quickly. So that's clearly something that is necessary for not only our mental health, but even in some ways our physical health.
Yeah, this is a story you tell that really stuck with me, and I wanted to ask you to tell us about this person. She's a Bosnian journalist named Nidzara Amatasevic. Tell us about her, because it's such an illuminating story.
The first war that I was in was Bosnia in 1993. And as I'm sure we all remember, a modern army, the Bosnian Serb army, surrounded a modern city, Sarajevo, and basically used the civilian population for target practice for 3 or 4 years. But they survived. They made it. They lived in their basements. They acted collectively. They had militia groups that defend their neighborhoods, and they made it. So I was there during those terrible times, and I didn't have a chance to go back to Sarajevo until a year and a half ago. But I met this journalist, Nidzara, who was 17 when the war broke out, and she didn't give much thought to it. She had a boyfriend. She had friends. This is sort of the adult's problem, until a Serb tank round slammed into her parents' apartment, and a shrapnel fragment almost took one of her legs off. Her father rushed her to the hospital in his arms through the shelling at night. And instead of amputating her leg, her father convinced the doctor to try to save her leg, and he did through a long surgical procedure that she had to endure without anesthesia because there was none in the city.
God.
And so when I saw her, she said to me when we met, she lowered her voice and she said, you know, it's weird. The war was so terrible, and thank God it's over, but we all miss it. The civilians all miss the war. And what she said was that she said, basically, we acted better then. We were better people then. We cared for each other. We were selfless. We looked out for each other. Now we just take care of our own individual lives and we're smaller people. And she said there's even graffiti in Bosnia that said things were better when they were bad, referring to the war.
So the question is it possible to restore some of that kind of joy or goodness of those kind of tribal relationships without war?
Basically, you're asking, how can we have it all? Like, how can we live in a safe, comfortable, modern society with all the amazing blessings and benefits that come with that and regain this sort of sense of community that throughout human history has been created by danger and by hardship? Can we have it all? Honestly, not quite. I don't think we can. But I think there's a lot we can do to foster more of a sense of community at the neighborhood level and all the way on up to the national level. I think we can. There are deliberate choices we can make as a society without burning down the suburbs and going back to living in lean-tos. I mean, obviously, that's not a possibility.
Well, I'm thinking that one example you brought up in the book, near the beginning, I think you were thinking about the recession, and you pointed out that as many people committed suicide after the recession, you know, after presumably losing their jobs or whatever, as were injured during some of our wars, And yet, of course, there was very little fallout for the people who crashed the economy, which is an example of undercutting community.
Yeah, I mean, one of the characteristics of an organic tribal society is that it is adamant about punishing anyone who threatens its safety and its welfare. That may be an enemy across the river, or it could be people in their own society that are acting in dangerous, unnoble ways. And so one of the things that's punished very, very quickly is a betrayal of the group. Stealing food, someone bullying other people into giving them more resources. So if you look at America, in 2008, a relatively small number of mostly men in the financial industry gambled with the welfare of this nation and hurt us tremendously. I mean, really put us in danger. They cost us, the recession cost us around $14 trillion. And if I'm remembering my math correctly, that's around $45,000 per person. So the people that did this to us, without exception, have not been punished. They haven't really even been sanctioned socially in very harsh ways. That's new, right? I mean, most societies in human history would take those people out and hang them. And I'm not advocating that. But when you ignore something that's so obviously bad for everybody, you're sending the message, as a nation, you're sending the message, you know what? There isn't really any there. I mean, you say, okay, we call ourselves America. But you know what? America won't even look out for its own interests. It won't even protect itself from itself. And if that's the case, you, the citizen, really don't belong to anything. It's a fiction.
Well, it's interesting. It makes me think, what would we do as a culture if we were serious about defending us, the people of the United States, with the same vigor that we use to defend us against, you know, supposed outside attacks?
Well, I think we would need a real revision of our sort of legal and moral system, political system, really, where people who are very powerful, economically and politically powerful, if they damage this country, that they experience justice, legal justice. I mean, the punishments for stealing $100 are way harsher than for defrauding the country of 100 million. That's not right. But, you know, in addition, I think the use of contempt in political speech for political rivals is really corrosive to the American soul. You know, it's a little bit like hearing your parents scream at each other when you're a kid. Like, wow, are mom and dad going to get divorced? Like, is this the end of this family? I think it's what it felt like to endure this ghastly election campaign of 2016. I mean, the kind of insinuations and mockery and derision and contempt that many candidates expressed for others and for voters was really grotesque. And I think it sends the message, again, like, there's no country here to defend. I mean, no one out at Restrepo, this outpost I was at, I mean, there were lots of tensions and dislikes, and there were guys who straight up hated each other, but no one had contempt for someone who might save their life tomorrow morning. You don't use contempt on someone who's inside the wire. And when you use contempt with a fellow American, say a Mexican-American, or your political rival, or a Democrat or a Republican, when you use contempt, and both sides do it, you're basically saying, you know what, you're not really American. You're not inside the wire. You're other. And you shouldn't be in this country. And, you know, when you accuse the president of deliberately trying to harm this country, you are undermining this democracy in ways that are far more dangerous than Al-Qaeda or ISIS ever could. It's a really, really corrosive thing to do. And I think it should be, it's protected under free speech, of course, but I think the social sanction against using that kind of speech should be so high that politicians stop doing it.
Sebastian, thank you so much for talking today. This was just great.
It's my pleasure.
Journalist Sebastian Younger is the author of Tribe, On Homecoming and Belonging. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.